When it's a hot day at Disneyland, there's nothing quite like finding a quiet little shady spot to cool off and rest a minute.
I agree. You can sure work up a sweat digging up the rich history, awesome details, and fascinating stories behind your favorite Disneyland attractions.
Ah, yes, indeed. Well, what do you say we take a load off right here under this oak tree?
I like the sound of that. You ever look up at the clouds passing by and see familiar shapes?
Of course I do. It's a perfect exercise for the creative mind. See, there's a rabbit right there.
Where?
Follow that big round one up to those two long lines and...
Oh, I see it. Yeah, totally a rabbit. Is he driving a taxi cab?
No, those are churros.
Do you see that long fat one with the bump on top?
Yeah?
It's a submarine.
Whoa!
Looks more like a churro to me.
Oh, and there's a whale swallowing a toy maker.
Oh, yeah, I see that. Cool.
Wait, where? Next to the churros?
Oh, Al.
Whoa, guys! There's a house up in that tree!
Where? Next to the submarine?
No, not the clouds. There's a literal house in that literal tree.
Oh my, he's right.
What are the odds? We sat down under the only treehouse in Toontown, guys.
Well, that can only mean one thing. We have found it.
Found what?
The deciduous home of that dinky dynamic duo, those redundant rodents, the mini Marmitinis of mischief, Chip and Dale.
Oh, me.
Oh, my.
Oh, monks.
Let's check it out, shall we?
Let's go.
Oh, I love me some Chip and Dale.
Me too. Everybody loves those two chip munchkins. You think they're home?
Well, in our tour of Toontown so far, we haven't had much luck finding the Fab Five at home. But we might get lucky here.
Well, to be fair, Freddy, technically Chip and Dale aren't officially part of the Fab Five, but...
You're right. The Fab Five is Mickey, Minnie, Donald, Goofy, and Pluto.
But Chip and Dale are a close 6 and 7, I would say.
They're a Disneyland fixture, for sure. Just look at any parade or cavalcade, and there they are.
And they're pretty much tied to the Fab Five in the cartoons as well.
You're right. Most of the classic Chip and Dale cartoons overlapped with the other Fab Five characters, especially Donald.
Oh yeah, poor Uncle Donald.
Disney animators knew this pair of pint-sized puffballs would prove to be the perfect provokers for one of their stars. But who?
Well, their first cartoon came out in 1943, giving Pluto a hard time in a short called Private Pluto. Then Disney legend Jack Hanna took over directing the Chip and Dale shorts and pitted Chip and Dale against Mickey Mouse in Squatter's Rights.
But when Hanna finally set them up as Donald Duck's antagonists, that's when the real magic began. Chip and Dale found their perfect victim, or a rival, I should say, with Mr. Duck, and their popularity took off throughout the 1950s as a result.
Yeah, I loved watching the Chip and Dale cartoons. Actually, I have really strong memories of Chip and Dale, sometimes even more than the other characters. You guys, do you have any good old Disney cartoon memories? I'm not talking about the big movies. I'm talking about those shorts. What are your memories of those?
Annie, what do you got?
Well, I'd say we didn't watch a lot. We didn't have like free reign of the television growing up. So I can't say that I got to see them air on TV, but we had a ton of sing-along song videos. We pretty much had the whole collection. So I remember seeing all of the characters through the sing-along songs. And that was my introduction. We watched those probably one every day.
Yeah, they were a fixture for my daughter and my son, just always, especially the Disneyland one and the Christmas one. We were
yes.
on repeat.
The Disneyland one was my favorite, too.
For me, it was definitely Rescue Rangers. That was, I mean, I had known Chip and Dale before that, but, I mean, again, as I've said many times before on this show, and I know that it makes me kind of a Disneyland, or I should say a Disney heretic, I never really grew up with a deep, vast love for the Disney cartoons and characters. And so when Rescue Rangers came out, I was like, oh, wait, Chip and Dale are adventurers? This is awesome! And that's when my love for them grew. And it was always forbidden fruit, because with the way that the Disney Afternoon worked here in Denver, Colorado back in the day, For those of you who didn't know this info, I don't know if I've ever shared this information before, but I was homeschooled, and I don't know if I've ever shared that with anybody.
Al, we could tell.
Yes.
Fair enough. Well, I wear a lot of corduroy.
Yeah. I almost said I homeschooled. But my wife homeschooled our two kids, so we can fly that freak flag around here.
Wait, Freddie, I didn't know that you homeschooled your kids.
Either. Yeah, I want to homeschool my kids. I think homeschooled kids are they are my favorite.
Well,
friends.
It's getting a lot more popular now.
Oh yes, homeschoolers back in the day, we earned our reputation. Whereas today, homeschoolers are a lot cooler. But I was homeschooled after first grade. So kindergarten, first grade, I was going to a public school, and I remember that in the afternoons, Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers would come on 25 minutes before I got home from school. And so by the time I would get home from school, I would race into the house, turn on the Disney Afternoon, and have maybe, if I was lucky, like 2 or 3 minutes of Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers excitement. And I think it's because of that, like I said, the forbidden fruit, the unattainable, it became even more awesome to me in my mind. And I mean, I grew up with, it's just, I have one sibling, my brother and I. And I think that especially those who have just two siblings like that can really relate with Chip and Dale, because there is this strange rivalry yet camaraderie at the same time with two characters that have such opposite personalities in a lot of ways. And that's why I think they're brilliant characters.
Yeah, I think I represent the older generation here on the show. I'm the Gen Xer. I'm the kid of the 70s and the 80s. And so for all of those of you who are of that group, you remember watching Uncle Walt on Wonderful World of Disney on Sunday nights. There was always Christmas specials, and Chip and Dale always seemed to have a piece in that, probably because they made Uncle Donald's Christmas go out the window. But yeah, that Chip and Dale, all of, you know, Donald, Mickey, Goofy, the rest, just, they did saturate part of, my life and the generation that I'm from. That was part of our lives, I think. So you mentioned Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers, great opportunity for everybody else. If you missed the last episode, we do go dive deep into, that cartoon itself, and the history behind it and the Disney Afternoon. So you should check that out. Well, here's something pretty cool I bet you didn't know. Chip and Dale also have a pretty deep history. So even before they started appearing in the cartoon shorts with Donald and the rest, they were there.
Yeah, how so?
Well, animation as an art form has always been sort of a balancing act between efficiency and sophistication.
Kind of like this show.
Oh, that's perfect. Comment below. So have you guys ever watched Fred Flintstone or Scooby-Doo and seen them run through a house and pass by the same table and lamp like a dozen times? You guys have seen that?
Yes.
So, or maybe you've seen a character who's static on the screen, but his mouth is moving and his eyes are blinking, but nothing else is moving. Okay.
Yep.
So those are a couple of the tricks animators use to sketch fewer drawings faster and cover a lot more screen time. So because they often sold cartoons to theaters back then by runtime, or even like film by the foot, efficiency was what paid the studios. So that's why
that
they
makes
make those
sense.
Shortcuts. Right. Mm. So now much of Disney animation at the time was known for being a little more sophisticated than some of the other studios, especially in television. So they had to use other tricks up their sleeves, like reusing old animation.
I think I know what you're getting at here, Freddie. I've seen videos where animators literally copied pieces of older Disney cartoons.
Is that true?
Yeah. Let's call it borrowing from their back catalog, Al.
You say Temuto.
Well, Chip and Dale's design can be traced back to very similar chipmunk characters in previous Disney films and shorts. As far back as Snow White and Bambi, you can see Chip and Dale's sort of heritage beginning.
Oh, the humanity.
And Chip and Dale actually made a cameo appearance in the bongo sequence of Fun and Fancy Free before they even got their official names. They weren't Chip and Dale yet, but they acted just like them. That's, voices and everything.
Yeah, that's crazy. Like, I didn't know this at all. And as an artist, I love to hear how artists solve problems to create something new. It's always fascinating to me.
I agree. Real quick, I just want to say that on Did You Know Disney, I think soon we need to talk about Fun and Fancy Free for Movie Club, because that movie is bizarre. And Bongo is a cartoon that shaped my childhood. And it's Bongo. Bongo. It feels very almost bizarre compared to the rest of the tone of Disney. But anyway, I'm wondering which came first, the Chippin or the Dale.
You guys are sure full of questions.
Well, if an acorn falls in the forest and Chip isn't around to hear it, Annie, does he blame Dale somehow?
How much chip could a chipmunk munch if a chipmunk could munch chip?
Guys, are you done?
Okay. Here's a real question for you, Annie. Pop quiz. Which one is Chip and which one is Dale?
Oh, that's easy. Chip dresses like Magnum P.I., and Dale dresses like Indiana Jones. Oh, wait. Is it the other way around?
Hold on. You're thinking of the Rescue Rangers.
Nah.
We'll get you. You've already talked about them. No, I'm talking about the real Chip and Dale. How do you tell them apart when they're in one of their shorts or running around the park posing with guests?
Wait, one of them is wearing shorts? I'm confused.
The cartoon shorts, Al. Give me a break.
I always used to just walk up to them and be like, Chip? And if they nodded their head, then I knew I was correct.
That's good.
Annie, as a twin, well, since you're not an identical twin, you can't feel that pain. But I feel like that's the pain that every twin has.
Oh, my gosh. I was Dale in the twin relationship. And my sister was definitely Chip.
I have never been able to tell the difference between Chip or Dale.
Okay, so here's what people will use as their way to tell Chip and Dale apart. Chip has a chocolate chip nose. It's a little brown dot of a nose. Whereas Dale, he's got the big red nose and the teeth separated. So you know he's the other one. So if you can think of Chip as the one with the chocolate chip nose, then you can pretty much figure out that Dale is Dale.
One of the other things that we notice here, though, is that you see this trend of two chipmunk characters coming up in other franchises. And
yeah,
so,
that's right.
Freddie, do you want to talk a little bit more about that?
Well, this is funny. I used to think that Chip and Dale were the same characters that did the... there was this bit in a cartoon where two chipmunks, that's how I remembered it, would stand by the door of their house and they'd say, "After you! No, after you! No, after you! Oh, I insist, after you!" And then they'd eventually, just before the cat or the dog that was chasing them got to them, they would both jump into the door and together and make it through at the exact same time. Well, that wasn't Chip and Dale. And I think a lot of people do get that confused. And it's
Mandela.
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny, the cartoon that was a Warner Brothers cartoon. They called them the Goofy Gophers. And they actually had a name kind of like Chip and Dale, but they were Mac and Tosh. They were gophers, not chipmunks, and Mac and Tosh were the ones doing the "after you, no, after you, I insist, after you."
I'm really curious as to the inception of their names. I mean, Mac and Tosh. I mean, obviously the apple, but they're gophers. Are gophers known?
That was a long
time ago. Are gophers
ago.
Known to eat apples?
Yeah, who knows? Well, it couldn't be. I mean, that's so far back. That's way before Macintosh computers.
Well, no, but they had like the Macintosh apple. Yeah,
oh,
it's a kind
that?
Of
oh,
apple.
Yeah.
Maybe.
I
don't know.
Do I
gophers
know?
Gophers are, they like to go into gardens. They probably
oh,
eat
yeah,
all kinds
right.
of
that,
fruits and veggies.
That might have to do with it. Well,
guys, I don't want to split hairs. I don't want to pull out my horticultural degree here right now, but you don't grow a tree in a garden. You grow it in an orchard. Guys.
Okay, well,
guys.
We have an apple tree in my garden.
If we're talking, do you actually have an apple tree in your garden?
Well, my parents do. Growing up, we had an apple tree in our garden.
So you had an orchard and a garden is what you're saying.
oh, Okay. Well, we had gophers. We had gophers.
Since you brought it up, Al, the names of Macintosh, I do not know the origin of those name, but for Chip and Dale, there was actually a wood cabinet maker at the time, Chip and Dale's Cabinets and Drawers, and that's what one of the Disney guys inside suggested that their name be Chip and Dale, because they were in the wood. So that's the origin of Chip and Dale's names, which
that's cute.
Interesting. Pretty fun. I've always wondered that, because you really wonder where these names come from. I mean, obviously, here in a couple of episodes when we talk about Mickey, there's a big story behind their names. And Goofy, yeah, like we've already talked about, is a little bit analogous. You don't really know exactly where the goof
his name came from.
Finally yeah. came up from. And so I think it's fascinating. And we never really did a study on Donald's name, like what the origins are for coming up with a character's name. I mean, with Donald, is it just simply because it's alliterative with duck? Or was there some, do you know, Freddie?
Because I know that you're pretty. I don't. That would be good research.
Well, that's something that we need to look into, is the origins. But that's actually a fascinating story about Chip and Dale. Thank you for sharing that.
just to kind of tie that up. I mentioned before that I always got Chip and Dale confused with those gophers. But there's probably a good reason why me and other people do. And that's because there was once a crossover joke by Chip and Dale where they did the after you. They started in on that gag, which was around the same time that the Macintosh gophers were doing that gag. And just before Dale got it really going between the two of them, Chip stopped all the action and kicked Dale in the butt, and then they went out the door. So I feel like that's sort of a dig on, or a friendly dig, or coaxing back and forth to Warner Brothers to kind of start a gopher war.
That is. Now, do you know, Freddie, who came first, the apple or the Chip and Dale?
I don't know, but I'm. Oh well, it would have to be Chip and Dale, because they date all the way back to Snow White, Bambi, etc. But their first cartoons were in the 1940s, and then they got their own series in 1950.
Okay. So then Mac and Tosh were derivative of Chip and Dale, not the reverse.
Yeah, if that it's that would be tough to claim, but
yeah, you know, or if they, I mean,
everybody was making buddy films back then, so buddy rodents would probably be a natural go-to.
Well, and I forget what the term is, but there is a term out there for people who come up with the same idea at the same time in different locations. It's an
inception.
Yeah, that's it. It was in my dreams. Yeah, it is something with inception. But yeah, it's the concept that two people had independent ideas that were very almost identical, but there's no way that they could have actually shared that idea with one another, so it wasn't cross-pollination. It's funky. I read it in a book by the woman who wrote Eat, Pray, Love.
Elizabeth Gilbert,
why I was reading this book.
Because it's a good book, actually. Yes, you know, she talks about how it's like you're visited by the muse. Like, you can be visited by the same muse, and it just happens. Yeah, I like that concept.
Of course you would know this stuff.
Of course I read that.
Oh my gosh. That's why we love having you around, Andrea, is you bring such an Annie perspective and a great perspective. But anyway, we've totally sidetracked here. Chip and Dale's popularity is huge, and it's no wonder, because they pulled up their stakes in Burbank and moved with Mickey and the rest of the Disney royalty to this little slice of heaven here in Toontown.
Yes. According to the official story of Toontown, Mickey and his friends learned about a quiet little town in Orange County where big Hollywood stars like themselves could get away from the hustle and bustle of Tinseltown.
Yeah, when Walt Disney, so this is according to story, when Walt Disney was looking for a place to put Disneyland, Mickey gave him a tip about some farm property outside of Toontown where he could build his Magic Kingdom.
And the rest, they say, is found in our Toontown episode.
Well said.
Chip and Dale's Treehouse opened with Mickey's Toontown at Disneyland on January 24th, 1993.
I remember that. You know what I remember most?
What, Freddie?
Going up the spiral stairs inside the tree and getting claustrophobic halfway up. I'm telling you, that thing is not made for big people.
No, poor Freddy. Did you make it out okay?
I don't know if I'm okay at all, but it took some twisting and bending. I made it out the other side.
But the real question is, Freddy, was it worth it?
Well, if I'm being honest, it's not much of an attraction.
I know what you mean, man. I mean, when we talk about Disney attractions, we usually talk about big thrills or eye-popping innovations. But Chippendale's Treehouse is basically just a staircase up into a little treehouse, and that's pretty much it.
Well, Al, you forgot the grand finale.
The grand finale? I don't remember that. What happens, Freddy?
Well, once you get up to the top of the stairs, you turn a little corner, and there, right in front of you, totally unexpected, is another staircase going back down.
Oh, boy. Ah, Freddy, it's not that bad.
No, you're right. It's not that bad.
I remember there being some pretty cute design elements up in the tree, like a little oak leaf area rug and acorn lamps, and it feels a lot like Chippendale's house in the cartoons. It's pretty cute.
You know, I didn't experience this attraction until I was well into my 20s. And Freddie, I feel the exact same pain about going up the staircase and instantly just feeling trapped. But I always got an eye out for the jokes. I noticed that there's a pantry shelf in there with jars of peanut butter, cashew butter, and acorn butter. All the butters that a couple of monks might need.
Tasty.
But really, that's all that's up there. I mean, kids like it, though. What kid doesn't like the excitement and imagination that comes from climbing in and exploring an awesome treehouse?
I completely agree. It's kind of a Disney tradition that just keeps on giving back.
A Disney tradition? Treehouses? What do you mean, Freddy?
Well, yeah, treehouses. And I guess man-made trees for attractions are all the way throughout Disney properties. That goes way back.
Let's so talk like, about that for a little bit. Yeah.
Like, for instance, I wrote a article on Tom Sawyer's Island, and Walt hired a boy to go around Tom Sawyer Island when it first opened in 1956 and help people with their fishing rods because you used to be able to fish in the rivers of America. Mm. And this Walt came to this kid and said, We're gonna build some new things on this island. What would you like to see? And this kid suggested a treehouse. And for a time, the treehouse on Tom Sawyer Island was the highest place that you could get in Disneyland and get the best view of Disneyland way back then.
That's awesome. That reminds me that there's actually somebody who I believe they posted on our Facebook group for the Backside of Water shared a picture of themselves sitting inside of that treehouse on Tom Sawyer's Island, and they just posted it recently. So I need to go back and look at that because I don't remember that, but that's really cool.
Yeah, and of course there's the big daddy of Disney treehouses. That's the Tarzan's treehouse now, but Swiss Family Robinson treehouse back when it was built in 1962.
Freddie, do you remember the scientific name for the tree?
Yes, I do. Do you?
Maybe. What is it?
I always screw it up, but it's the Disneyodendron Sempervirens grandis.
There's something so majestic awesome. About saying that name. I just want that to be on my family crest for some reason.
Yeah. Well, what's so funny about that is that, like, that's what I love about the Disney stuff. Like, they probably threw it in as a joke, but as soon as they said it, they were like, "We're that creative. We gave this big fake tree a Latin name, and I just love it." Do you know what it means?
I do. Annie, do you know what it means?
I don't know Latin that well, but I know that it's like Disney Dendron, I'm guessing would be like a tree or branch. Semper large is grandis.
Semper fi. It's a marine tree. Right.
I don't know. I can pick apart a few things, but I don't know enough Latin.
No,
tell us.
It's the large, ever-blooming Disney tree.
Yeah.
And the reason why it's ever-blooming is because it has 300,000 man-made leaves on that sucker.
Crazy.
Yes. Well, I'll say this. One of the things that I always love is surprises in history. And way, way, way back in the day, many years ago, when Harrison and I were exploring the history of Tarzan's treehouse, he and I both were just like, oh, this is going to be a real snore fest. And then when we started looking into the building of this treehouse, folks, it is amazing. I highly recommend. That's one of our most hidden gem episodes, because there is so much that you learn about this treehouse and how it was built. And I just recently, we may have some listeners right now, I just recently did a little cross-pollination takeover of the Howard Johnson's Anaheim, and I did a little quiz over there, and I was like, are you team Swiss Family Robinson treehouse or team Tarzan? And I was like, Swiss Family's gonna kill it. And Tarzan won by a landslide, which blew my mind.
Wow. Yes. It probably says a lot about the age of our audience.
That's probably true.
Because us old folks, we sure do like that Swiss Family treehouse. But they've got some nods in there that help it still feel like home.
Oh, totally. I still think that there's nothing that beats Swiss Family, especially down in Walt Disney World. It is just pure magic.
Yep. I'm going to say, though, for the Tarzan treehouse, the draw for me is that Phil Collins music. I think that's one of the best soundtracks. But I'm not even kidding. One of the best Disney soundtracks. Like, it gets me.
Yeah. I agree.
And you just feel it when you're climbing up the treehouse and visiting all the little spots. It's amazing.
Does the leopard scare you? Every time I'm going up there, I like kind of slink away from it, because I know at any second now it's going to go, and I'm gonna jump.
It spits that air out at you, too, and you're just like, It becomes more like 4D in that way. I love the treehouse. And again, I've said it 1,000 times, but there is no better view of the park than right before you climb up and see the leopard up there. And you look around and can see all of New Orleans Square into Critter Country, Frontierland, Adventureland, and then now Galaxy's Edge off in the distance.
Yeah, that's great.
It is just a magical spot. Another magical spot is in our little tiki paradise over in the lanai of the Enchanted Tiki Room. We've got another great tree there.
Yeah, that's right. Tangaroa, the father of all gods and goddesses.
Stand back.
Yeah, he appears before you as a mighty tree. Do you know that he, all those tiki gods in the lanai at Tiki Room were all designed by Raleigh Crump, Disney legend?
It has his signature designs, without a doubt, on those.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think that there's any more peaceful place, truthfully, than the lanai on a quiet evening, grabbing a Dole Whip and just watching the pre-show. Not even necessarily going in and watching the Tiki Room, but being under Tongaroa's mighty branches there and just sitting listening to that music. There is nothing better.
Do you guys remember the Eagle Tree on Tom Sawyer's Island when you're on the Rivers of America? Do you remember that?
No, I actually don't.
This is brand new for me.
Okay, so early on, when they first started sending boats around that river, they had an attraction, and tons of great Frontierland history. We'll have to use this in your – I won't tell too much, so you can do it in next time you do a Frontierland episode.
Yeah.
But there was a settler's cabin on the backside of Tom Sawyer Island, and it was on fire. That was the big feature of it.
Oh, wow. Yes.
You remember that? Well, the feature, the story there changed over the years. First, the settler had been attacked by Indians. Then they thought better of that storyline and changed it to he was drunk and passed out, and that's why his house was on fire. And then they got rid of, they thought better of that storyline, and they added a fake tree there with a giant bird's nest on top with an eagle and two eaglets. And the house, the cabin's still on fire, and that's why the eagle is freaking out. What do I do? So it gives you this sort of sense of danger as you pass by. That's a cool treehouse at Disneyland that I didn't think of when I first started thinking about all this stuff. I'm like, oh, yeah, and the eagle tree.
I really wish, because we actually cover that in the Rivers of America episode, or Tom Sawyer's Island episode. And I wish that I would have been able to see that cabin burning. Right now, I believe, last time we were there, Harrison and I took the canoes. And we went around that backside. And the cabin's not on fire, obviously, anymore. But I think they're playing it off as though that's Mike Fink's cabin now. Is that?
Yeah, that's right.
Am I right?
Yeah, they did, and they called it Mike Feek's Cabin, and after a while they got rid of the eagle, they got rid of the, they put a sign that said it was Mike Feek's Cabin, but then they totally moved it, maybe even demoed the old one and put up a new one. It's still Mike Feek's Cabin, but it's in a different spot now.
Okay. Well, and then obviously we've got in the long lineage chronologically here, we've got Chip and Dale's Treehouse in 1993.
Yeah, technically, it's Disney's first. It's the first treehouse if you go by the story that it was there right before Disneyland.
If it came in 55, that is absolutely correct. I never even thought about that. But then you also have the technology tree in the beloved Inventions coming around in 1998.
Do you guys remember that?
Like, you guys, that was, I never so... went to Inventions.
Oh, yeah.
I missed out. Was...
No, I don't know if I'd say missing out, Annie.
No. Really, it was just this big blue glowing tree with solar panels on it. And you could watch, you had, it was kind of in the center of a circular staircase that got you upstairs to see the Honeywell exhibit. So,
of course, security systems.
Not a ton of fun there, but it was a cool Disney tree. Which I just loved. Anybody been to Animal Kingdom and seen the Tree of Life there?
It is a sight to behold.
It really is. The animal carvings on the trunk. What I love about it, Annie, you would love this, is all the artists who carved animals into the side of this tree to make it look like it was made, that the wood is made of living things. Everybody was given a section and told, do what you want.
Which is rare in Disney.
You use this pattern of, you know, this is how we're going to carve it, this is how we're going to make it look, but you let the tree tell you what you're to put here, which is just fascinating and beautiful.
Oh, and it's so huge. It is just like, it's an engineering feat to see the size of that Tree of Life. I'm just curious how they hold that entire thing up.
Where's this in the park, by the way? Is it at an entrance?
Right in the middle.
Yeah, right, it's the like middle. The main, cool. It's the main weenie of the park. It's almost like the castle view for the park.
Yeah.
Anywhere you are in the park, if you look, you identify where the Tree of Life is, and then it kind of orients you to you are in the park. But just fascinating. It was actually built from an oil rig base. Like, they recycled and turned upside down an oil rig in order to build the structure for that thing. Well, it's got to survive hurricanes, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, that's very true. That's very true. But what I think is really cool is the fact that underneath the roots of this tree, you've got the It's Tough to Be a Bug show that used to be over in A Bug's Land in California Adventure. What better place to have that show set up than under the roots of this giant tree? And it absolutely makes you feel like you're Flick size.
Yeah, it really does. You shrink down. Yeah, that's
and then,
cool.
Yeah, and then over in Magic Kingdom, we've got, coming around 1999, we've got Owl's House. And, this is something that I've never really paid a ton of attention to.
Well, you know, for those of us who grew up on the West Coast area and didn't go to Disney World very often, we don't understand what they lost when we kind of get it. When Winnie the Pooh came in over here, they put in the Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh over here in Disneyland. They took out our beloved Country Bear Jamboree.
Yeah.
But what they took out at Disney World to put in the new Fantasyland, which included Many Adventures, was their submarine ride themed as the Nautilus and Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. And the interwebs went nuts. That was the first big protest of Disney doing anything against it. And out in front of the Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh attraction is Owl's House. It's a tree with a treehouse on top, and kids can go inside. It doesn't have all the amazing features of Chip and Dale's house with stairs that go up and down, but it does have an area inside that you can go inside and look around. And there's some pretty cool Easter eggs in there, too. So, like, check this out. In the ride, you can pass by a picture of Mr. Toad handing over the deed to that tree to Owl.
Very cool. Yeah. The passing of the torch of sorts.
The passing of the torch. Wow. And then there's actually like a little sort of a smudge or almost like an indent that's shaped like the Nautilus. To give tribute to the Nautilus and to Mr. Toad being taken out. So we feel you, Florida friends, with your loss.
Sad.
I will say this, though. Their Many Adventures of Winnie the Pooh is awesome. The Walt Disney World version is incredible. The interactive queue alone is absolutely worth going on that ride for. If I recall, that was one of the first attempts that they made in like more of a fully interactive queue in Walt Disney World is with Winnie the Pooh.
That's right.
Like you've got little games and stuff that you can play and all these different activities to keep you and your kids entertained throughout the attraction's wait area, and it's awesome. Another one that we have to point out is our good old friend Patrick Begorra, the little man of Disneyland's house that's settled right there in the heart of Adventureland. Have you, Annie, have you seen the little man of Disneyland's house?
No.
You know, this is something that I didn't realize that it had come in just in 2015 because our buddy Dave Nelms is the one who first pointed this out to me around that 2015-16 time. And he was like, oh, you have to go see the little man of Disneyland's house. And I was like, what are you talking about, Dave? Have you gotten did you hit your head today? And then we looked into it, and sure enough, Patrick Begorra lives right outside of the queue there, or queue area entrance of Indiana Jones.
Oh my gosh. I got to go see that. I have to go see that.
In fact, his he lives at the base of the tree among the roots. There's a little door and a window of the tree that actually supports the sign for the Indiana Jones attraction. So if you're looking for the home of the little man of Disneyland, you look for the Indiana Jones sign, the attraction sign, and follow the branches down to the tree, and you'll find out, wait a minute, that's not a real tree. That's the home of a little leprechaun. There's a lot of story there. I don't know if you want to share that now, but the little man of Disney. Oh no, let's save that for the Adventureland update episode. What do you say?
I really like that. I really like that idea, and I think that one of the big honorable mentions, though it's not man-made, is the petrified tree over in Frontierland. This tree is amazing. So the reason why I love it is because being from Colorado, being a Colorado native, this tree is from about 90 miles south of my house in Colorado, well, 60 miles south of my house, called Colorado Springs. And there's a really cool story behind this, and it's a very often misunderstood story where Walt and Lillian, and we go into this actually in our Frontierland episode. So if you want to go back and hear a more in-depth version of this, feel free to jump back and listen to our Frontierland episode if you haven't. But the story in a nutshell goes, nutshell, get it, Chip and Dale. hi!
Way to tie it in there, pal.
Walt and Lillian were going on a little road trip together. And Walt used to love stopping by all these little roadside destinations and these little places that offered knickknacks and curios. And one of these was a museum that had petrified trees and had a giant bug collection. And Walt Disney was fascinated by this thing. And so, of course, Walt Disney being Walt Disney said, I want to buy this and bring it to Disneyland. Which, imagine being that kind of guy. I like this. I'm going to buy it and bring it to my land.
Well, now think about this. Before you go any further, people aren't picturing this in their head. It is the size of a Studebaker set up on its side and solid petrified wood.
It's humongous. So,
what are you going to put it in the back of the car there, Walt?
Exactly. How are you going to transport this? Well, and the funny thing is, as he's trying to negotiate the purchase of this petrified tree museum and bug collection, Lillian is out in the car being like, this is our vacation. And he is sitting inside of this museum trying to haggle with this guy. And eventually, Walt had to give up because the guy wouldn't allow the museum to be shipped over to Disneyland. But he was able to secure that petrified tree. And in the park now, it says on the plaque that it was a gift from Lily and Disney, right? Isn't that how it says it? And exactly. And so if you get the joke,
like, from Lillian to Walt.
Walt originally, quote unquote, gifted that tree to Lillian as to basically say, thanks for putting up with me. And this is like the metaphor of how difficult I could be as a spouse. And then she gifts it back to him to put in the park, basically saying, I don't want this hunk of junk sitting around. So go put it in your playground, Walt.
Yeah. Yeah, and so the plaque on the petrified tree is actually a miss. If you were to just read it as it is, you would believe that Lillian bought it for Disney. And this is so fun about Disney legends, is things grow out of inside stories and inside jokes, and yet the truth is Walt bought it for himself, but the sign says Lillian bought it, so it's pretty cool.
Exactly. And the thing that after looking at all these trees, the thing that I'm just really curious about is why do we have an obsession with trees in the parks? I mean, do you think that there is some sort of deeper understanding of that? Do they represent something? Is there something about us as human beings that are just fascinated by the life that is brought by trees through blooming fruit, photosynthesis, all that kind of stuff? What do you guys think?
Well, I've always felt like trees were like the natural version, like nature's buildings.
Ah.
So they work. I mean, the fact that you can make tree houses is really cool, and we see plenty of those in Disneyland. But they're also just these really, I don't know, they just complement. They are our structures that we see, and they live with us.
I love that perspective, Annie.
Yeah, that's how I've always felt about them.
Freddie, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, not to get too spiritual, but all the world religions use trees as a metaphor, whether it's for of life and growth and death and regeneration. You know, the Bible starts with the tree of life in the center of a garden. And that's where people want to be, is surrounding in the shade of a protective tree that gives fruit, gives life. And so it's pretty ingrained in humanity to want to be part of the trees.
Just knowing that among trees are a sign of protection. They're a sign of life. They represent so much of us as human beings. And I think that that's something that's interesting that I've never intellectualized on any level. All of the different, and I'm glad that you pointed this out, Freddie, that there are so many trees out there, because you never really think about how many trees are involved in Disneyland. And again, as they say, art is just a reflection of us as human beings. And this is just a reflective piece of our love and obsession with trees, both on the symbolic level as well as the physical level too. So that's fascinating. Guys, we just got really deep.
I know, like root deep. Our roots go deep in this one, and our branches spread wide. This is so cool. There's tons of interesting trees. Like Chip and Dale, we thought this episode would be about a treehouse that you go up and you go down, and that's it. But we got so deep, and there's so many of them in the Disney parks. I just love that we got to go so deep into that.
Yeah, and it's really nice just to put it all together and have a nice broad perspective of these trees.
I agree. I mean, we've named a lot here, but I bet our listeners out there right now screaming at their iPod minis. Wait, iPod minis?
Their iPod shuffles.
Oh, yeah, that's right. They're saying, wait, what about this tree? What about the tree you guys are focusing on this episode? If you've got more Disney-made trees we haven't thought of, friends, go to our Backside of Water Facebook group and please tell us, because I want us all to know the trees that we haven't talked about, and major points for including a picture if you've got one.
Yes, please do that. One thing we haven't mentioned yet about Chippendale's treehouse is the acorn ball pit that used to be at the exit.
Wait, you mean the acorn ball crawl, right, Annie?
Yeah. At the exit of the treehouse, you still pass by a big pit that looks like a cave created by tree roots. And that used to be the acorn ball crawl.
Yes, sirree. So from 1993 to 1998, kids could complete their exploration of going up the tree and down the tree with a romp and a pile of acorn-themed plastic balls.
Yeah, it's just like Chip and Dale. You could dive into a knee-deep acorn stash and dream of your rodent riches.
You know, I think I'd prefer just a little bit of a roll and a romp in a churro pit.
Oh, boy. with some salted caramel sauce out.
Now you're speaking my language, pal.
Oh, that sounds sticky. The balls eventually went away, just like the inflatable floors in Goofy's bounce house.
Yeah, it's all roped off now with that playground netting, but I wonder why they took it out.
Although there's never been an official reason given by the company, it seems pretty obvious that maintenance, safety, and sanitary concerns would have played a big part in this attraction's demise.
Yeah, bye-bye ball pit.
And bye-bye pink pie.
Thankfully, it really is something that you think about for about 4 seconds. And you say, okay, we're going to have 50,000 people in the park. What should we put in there that's going to be safe and sanitary? A ball pit. I just want to know who is in charge of that thought. And again, I think that it kind of represents Chippendale's treehouse in general, that it's like, we need a spot to put some kids, to let them have some fun while their parents refuel.
Yeah, right.
But I mean, after thinking about this, it makes me wonder, is that it? Is that all there is to Chippendale's treehouse? Stairs up, stairs down, and now a roped off empty ball pit play area?
Yeah, well, it appears that way. Still, it remains a fun little piece of Toontown's landscape, which makes a place like Disneyland greater than the sum of all its parts.
I agree with that. I think that's very well said. Now, listen, guys, before we go, I want to ask one more question.
Yeah, what's that, Al?
So when we first started touring Toontown, Freddie aptly suggested that we try to identify Walt Disney's personality traits in the individual personalities of the Fab Five characters. Now, you said they all have a bit of Walt in each one of them, and I think that goes beyond the Fab Five into these extraneous fabs as well, don't you think?
Yeah, that's right. So Goofy, he embodies Walt's dogged determination to try and fail and try again.
Yeah, and Donald was Walt's infamous temper.
Exactly. So I was wondering, even though Chip and Dale aren't officially part of the Fab Five like we talked about, do we recognize any of Walt's quirks in these two?
I think so.
I tend to agree. I think that, I mean, Walt Disney, there's people who talk about his famous focus that he had. And he was able to think around an idea unlike anybody else out there because he basically had brain superpowers. But at the same time, the dude was extremely clever. The guy could see a great gag or joke from a mile away. And that is absolutely Chip, is focused and like clever. Chip.
Yeah, I agree. And Dale, Walt was a prankster. He'd do pranks around. And he was also a little bit, like Goofy. He could be distracted and not get lost in his own studio. So that's a little bit like our goofy little Dale.
Oh, absolutely. It's amazing to see that there's the ability to have such two conflicting and seemingly opposite personality traits of being silly, goofy, and scattered, yet at the same time extremely focused. And I think that this also plays into that idea that Walt was not a singular character. The dude was as dynamic as human beings come, for better or for worse. And I think that Chip and Dale are great embodiments of that duality and more. Duality is not even the right phrase to use with Walt Disney, because that guy was more multifaceted and dynamic. And I think that we'll be studying the psyche of Walt Disney for centuries to come because of this very idea.
Yeah, to coin a phrase that's usually attributed to Bono's characteristics, Walt is a nice bunch of guys.
Ah, I think that's perfect. I think that is a perfect way to say that. So, well, guys, I think that it's time to roll this acorn forward and close the episode. What do you say?
Yes, sir. Keep moving forward.
Exploratio continua.
So, folks, if you enjoyed our little chipmunk-sized episode today, please consider giving us a friendly 5-star review on Apple Podcasts.
You can also follow show updates and fun stuff we do by following us on Instagram. Search Backside of Water Podcast, and you're going to find lots of great stuff on Instagram.
You can also join our fun little Facebook community by searching for the Backside of Water Podcast there as well. You can follow me and Freddie on the socials as well. You can find Freddie on Instagram as Skipper Freddie and me as Annie Ruget.
This episode itself was written by our own Freddie Martin. Thanks, pal.
Hooray!
Recording engineering was done by this lovely cast, Freddie Martin, Andrea Ruget, and myself, Alex Stewart.
And show production was flawlessly executed by the captain of this leaky ship, Alex Stewart. Well done, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, finally, be sure to check out our sister podcast that we've talked about a few times on this episode, Did You Know Disney? A show where we dig a little deeper, explore a little further, and discover even more of the magic within the wonderful world of Disney. You can find that show wherever you found this show.
Now, as you exit, please watch your head and watch your step.
And if you happen to miss your step and hit your head,
please watch your language. Goodbye, folks.